Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So it really breaks my heart what you just told me. I didn't know that. But you can see, I do think that the atmosphere towards Muslims has changed.
I think it is fair to say Muslims in Britain feel when it comes to the political and journalistic class, we have few friends. Most politicians, even those who are elected in large Muslim areas, are unwilling to act with fairness or represent our concerns. Instead, this establishment often foments naked animosity towards our faith and religious symbols and contributes to a hostile environment. The only consolation, we tell ourselves, is that things are worse in Europe. Yet we remain on edge, waiting for the next faux outrage that yet again maligns our community. My guest today, the journalist Peter Oborn, stands out as one of the few defenders of our community in the mainstream press. Over the past two decades, he has worked tirelessly to speak truth to power. He is currently a writer for the Middle East Eye and was named British Press Awards Columnist of the Year in 2013. His latest book is The Fate of Abraham, Why the West is Wrong About Islam, which takes a look at the often opaque world of the Islamophobia industry. Importantly, Oborn is a conservative, and until 2019 was a member of the Conservative Party until he resigned in disgust at the Boris Johnson leadership. I found this interview particularly fascinating. Peter provides an insider's perspective of how Islam has been deliberately fashioned to be the enemy within. I suspect many of you will find his analysis explains your lived experience since 9/11. Our conversation takes us to British conservatism, King Charles's comments on Islam, and how many young Muslims are looking to leave the UK, a trend I suspect that will only intensify over the coming decade. I am your host, Muhammad Jalal, and this is the Thinking Muslim podcast. Please do remember to subscribe on your favourite podcast app, as well as on our YouTube channel. And do remember to leave a review. This helps us reach more listeners. Peter Oborn, thank you for coming to my show, The Thinking Muslim. It's great to have you here with us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, Peter, I mean, I've been looking forward to this discussion because I think you are a rare, maybe even unique example of a journalist in the mainstream media who has consistently called out politicians and the political establishment on their positions towards Muslims and Islam. I want to explore the growing Islamophobia in Britain and Europe, and I also want to take a look at the role of the British Conservative Party and the underlying motivations and ideologies of the modern party. You recently published a book, The Fate of Abraham, Why the West is Wrong About Islam. So let's maybe start here. What is it that the West gets wrong about the religion of Islam?
The West has got Islam wrong systematically. I'm sure Islam is, or Muslims, to say perhaps more properly, has been wrong about the West as well. But you can trace a set of bogus, bigoted, and violent ideas relating to Islam, right from, you know, the Crusades, Pope Urban the Second, sort of Islamophobic sort of nonsense in the 11th century, right up to, you know, the neoconservative tracts emerging from Washington in the end of the 20th and start of the 21st century is a very consistent, the same tropes, the same quite blinkered misunderstanding of the teachings of the Prophet and the nature of Islam.
Is it a misunderstanding of Islam? And when we think about the Crusades and the way Islam was characterized and the more recent neoconservative movement, can we put that down to ignorance, misunderstanding, or is there a willful attitude to present Islam in the most extreme terms?
I would say that when it comes to sophisticated people who ought to know better, for instance, the United States, intelligence operatives, politicians, academics, and so forth, the same applies in Britain as well, that it has to be regarded as a willful issue because all of the facts are available. And one of the things I do in this book is to show how intellectuals and politicians and media set about constructing a false discourse or a discourse about Muslims and about Islam in the West in the wake of 9/11, which was based on a series of deliberate misapprehensions about the teaching of the Prophet.
In your book, you make reference to a secretive Home Office unit that draws on Cold War methods, along with a network of influential think tanks, some drawing on dubious American funding. Tell me about this network of Islamophobia you uncovered.
I really looked very hard at the response in Western capitals to 9/11. 9/11 was a blessing particularly for the United States, I think, in the sense that you can show how there is a kind of sympathy or common set of misapprehensions, almost as if Al-Qaeda and the neocons kind of needed each other. They show the same false apprehension or false understanding of Islam as a violent religion. They show the same readiness to embrace violence, and they show the same hostility to democratic or representative institutions and the rule of law. And they sort of mirror each other, on either side of the Atlantic or 6,000 miles away in Afghanistan and New York. And actually, Islam, which is to say 9/11, came to the rescue of the United States, which had really been bereft after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1990, because they needed an enemy. And 9/11 was curiously foreshadowed by the Huntington thesis about clash of civilizations, in which he said that Islam had bloody borders and predicted wars or struggles between Islam and the West, representing two countervailing and opposite forces. And of course, 9/11 came along and gave every excuse for the United States to go to war. Now, the central argument of my book actually is that, as I think most people who have an understanding of this subject, is that actually there's much more in common between the three great monotheistic religions than we have against each other. That was not the analysis taken by the think tanks and the politicians and the officials and the media in the West. They set out to categorize, stigmatize, and turn Islam in the West into the enemy within. Now, this was, they very self-consciously modeled themselves, and they went back to the early years after 1945 and the emergence of the Cold War, when Western intellectuals and policymakers set out a structure which, in order to deal with what was a real menace, the menace of Soviet communism. And they did that by creating fake civil society movements and organizations, magazines, media, which, while appearing to be socialist or pro on the left, were actually run by organs of the CIA or MI6 in Britain. And they divided between good communists, i.e. communists who were sympathetic to the United States, and bad communists who had to be kind of combated. It led to this sort of a series of neuroses, of which the most notorious, of course, is McCarthyism, where, you know, any film producer or politician in the United States who'd had any kind of sympathy on the left was stigmatized and persecuted, and in some many cases driven out of the United States by the McCarthyites.
We know that there is now a state and a threat to or a challenge to America that comes from a state, China, rather than from non-state actors like Al-Qaeda or ISIS or a perceived threat from Islam. I mean, in your reading, do you think these think tanks and policy units have now moved beyond Islam, albeit with maybe a residue of Islamophobia persisting?
I think that's true in the United States. And in fact, it was really interesting. About a year or maybe 2 years ago, the Henry Jackson Society, which was a keen Islamophobic organization, suddenly started to publish a series of tracts and sort of policy position papers denouncing China and identifying China as the new enemy, which took a lot of pressure off Muslims. On the other hand, in Europe, well, Europe has been obliged to follow that agenda, but nevertheless, the pressure on Muslims is increasing still. It may be more relaxed in the United States. We're seeing the emergence of some very attractive Muslim politicians, but in the States, and Joe Biden is not much less inflammatory than Trump. But on the other hand, in Europe, I think the thing's getting darker and darker. You just think of the French elections. Macron has adopted the rhetoric of the far right and the policies. In Britain, I see Truss as pushing through a whole series of almost sort of securitizing Islam or Muslims in a way which intensifies what was already the situation. And we see the think tanks, Policy Exchange, putting out position papers, a new security architecture, an intensification of the prevent strategy. And so in Europe, I'm very, very gloomy at the moment.
And why do you think that is? Is it just narrow electoral advantage? Islam is easy to win votes off.
Part of that is true. The part of the strategy of the conservative government, and it is not conservative, remember, in a traditional way. It's not. It's actually a far right government, which has got the name conservative. It's actually in many ways a neocon government or a radical right government. The traditional conservatives have been, you know, thinking of people like Ken Clark, the former chancellor, Dominic Grieve, the former attorney general, and people like that. They've been driven out of the party. And so it's been captured by the far right. And or the extreme right. And that has consequences. They are determined to wage a series of culture wars. And we're already seeing this with the so-called war on woke, which is really, again, inventing a series of imaginary enemies. But one of those wars is too tempting for them, I think, is that war on what you might say politically active Muslims, people who take Islam seriously, who try to bring it into public life. And I think what you can see, and there've been several articles by people connected to Policy Exchange, David Cameron being the most, the former prime minister being the most egregious in a piece in the Times, people connected with the Henry Jackson Society have been advocating a new regime towards Muslims. And of course we're awaiting the Shawcross review, long delayed, and we're of the prevent strategy, and he's not going to review it in the sense that, you know, he's addressing its faults. He seems to have made plain that he's just making it worse, and that's significant and troubling.
You talk about an attempt to conflate innocuous conservative Islamic practice with extremism. How is this done, and what lies behind this approach?
Yeah, I have a chapter or two on this subject. It's very insidious, and it involves the creation of a new kind of public language or discourse about Muslims. I trace the invention or the reclassification or reinvention of certain words, like one of them is extremism, which is applied essentially to Muslims who show Muslim who celebrate Muslim characteristics. I use this very dangerous, I think dangerous, anti-democratic word or phrase, I should say, non-violent extremism. Now, we can all agree that violent extremism, i.e. blowing people up, shooting them, terrorism is terrible. Everybody has a common duty to combat that and denounce it. But nonviolent extremism identifies language or clothing or just religious practices, which, while not violent, are somehow unacceptable. They're bringing in a thought crime, or another way of putting it, which I'm still brooding on, is that they are attacking religious liberty. I mean, Muslims have I'm not talking about Muslims. We all have a right to celebrate our religious or non-religious beliefs. You know, I'm an Anglican. You know, we go to church. We put on robes. We have all kinds of traditions which are bound up with the state. Catholics. There's no Catholic priests who are women, by the way. You don't read about that because nobody really wants to, no politician ever wants to offend the Catholic vote, but you can go after Muslims who have mores or customs which do not fit well with modern secular liberal society. They're a very safe target. So the concept of nonviolent extremism has been invented. Then you have the concept of radicalization. It really interests me. A modern white Western politician who wants to make herself or himself appear interesting. So I'm a radical, but on the other hand, a radical Muslim is going to be put on a program of surveillance, and it may be criminalized. Likewise, if you want to denounce a white politician, you say, "Oh, these people are he or she is moderate, or rather a moderate fellow." Whereas, if you want to praise within the public domain a Muslim, you call them moderate, because the moderate Muslims are the good ones. And this double standards in public discourse is a way of disenfranchising millions of our fellow citizens. You also feel that they've also been Muslims, politically active Muslims, have also been cancelled long before the word cancel culture was invented. I go into this, these secret lists, which are, have existed in Whitehall, to keep out certain very, very reasonable and public-spirited figures from the public debate. They still won't talk to a Muslim Council of Britain. MEND, you know, which is a civil society organisation, if there ever was one, that's constantly under attack from Whitehall. I look into the setting up of organisations on the model of the Cold War when they were fighting communism, which are actually run or funded or authorised by the state, but masquerade as civil society organisations, and so on. And that is, that is part of, to use a phrase actually adopted by Saeed Avasti, who's still a member of the Conservative Party, I think, and was and had to leave the Conservative Party, well, left in protest against the attitude of the British government towards Gaza in 2014, called the enemy within.
How much of this is less political and more part of a broader, I don't know, project of liberalism to chasten religion? I mean, Islam is taken probably, and I may be wrong here, Peter, but it's Muslims are far more strict in their adherence to the faith over probably your average Anglican is.
There's no question that secular liberalism, or coercive liberalism, one might call it, sees Islam as a target. And this explains one of the difficulties which Muslims have in Britain today. You know, on the far right, or even the, you know, the moderate right, the conservative right is often hostile to Islam as a proxy for racism, because they're so many Muslims in Britain are immigrants or have brown skins. And because racism is illegal, anti-black or anti-Asian racism is actually against the law, Islamophobia it becomes a proxy. Attacks on Muslims become a proxy, and that is on the bigotry of the far right. Now, at the same time, the Muslims in Britain have been fighting on another front. They're not just open to attack by the conservative wings, by certain branches of conservatism. You also have progressive attacks. I mean, Christopher Hitchens was the commander-in-chief, as it were. You know, he said it got it going with his denunciations of Muslims. And that was then followed by a string of others. I mean, The Guardian, The Observer, you know, papers which you would have expected to have stood up for minorities actually have tended to join in these criticisms with these. And I've studied this. I've written a long study of the press reporting of the Trojan Horse affair, for instance, which, as you probably know, is a complete fabrication start to finish. But what was interesting, you don't just get the Murdoch Press, the Associated Newspapers, the Telegraph, you also get the Guardian / Observer on the side of a state attack on a minority group, on Muslims in East Birmingham. And there's virtually nobody who will stand up for them. And when the New York Times, shamingly for the British press, was the first attempt to have a look at what was going on, of course, they were denounced left, right and centre, most of all by the Observer. And I find that, and that is a problem which, and it is, I think, that some secularists are against all religions, but the easiest target is where they're most likely to have allies. The easiest target is on the liberal is Islam, even though they're against all religions and they'd love to have a bash at Catholicism too, or Hinduism, or the whole lot, because they, and that I think is quite authoritarian ultimately. It's and it's certainly unconservative.
I want you to elaborate on what you just said there about the journalistic class and how it often echoes the talking points of the political establishment. I mean, you used to be a journalist for the Daily Telegraph until you resigned. And in many ways, that it's a mouthpiece for the conservative establishment. How endemic is Islamophobia in journalism today? And how does it work? I mean, does it come from above an editorial line, or is it woven into the culture of most mainstream organizations?
The answer to that is both. And so if you look at the most powerful media magnate in the Western world by far, Rupert Murdoch, he, I think, if you look at his record, has made Islamophobic comments. He's made his views known. And if, remember, he doesn't just control the Times, which is notoriously, he regularly fabricates stories about Muslims, as well as the sort of denunciations of people like Melanie Phillips, but also the Sun, Sunday Times, led the way very largely on the Trojan horse affair, led the way on the weaponization of grooming gangs against Muslims. I mean, that was terrible reporting, and lots of other cases. And of course, Mr. Murdoch owns Fox News, which is a sort of deranged organization with a nightmare Islamophobic agenda in the United States. So that clearly comes from the top. But I think it's also a culture whereby it's extremely easy to sell a story to a paper. And that's what you're doing as a reporter. You need to get a byline. And if it's one which pillories Muslims so much, the better. So there is a news desk culture whereby you can plant those stories much more easily, whereas it's much more difficult to sell a story which puts Muslims, not impossible, but very difficult to sell a story to a news desk which puts Muslims in a positive light. Equally, they won't report, they won't correct false stories. I mean, Trojan Horse, a classic case in point, when the case against the teachers fell, that collapsed. That was scarcely reported. When the various reports came out, which showed there hadn't been a conspiracy, ignored very largely. And so it's a very one-sided, and I've spent quite a significant amount of time over the last 20 years, and it goes into my book, exposing those false stories.
You've made reference there to the Trojan horse affair, but I mean, one can read that as a multi-layered collusion. The judiciary, Ofsted, independent layers of the British establishment, in a sense, colluded to deny a voice for these teachers and for those who were calling out this letter to be a fake. I mean, you know, is it as pervasive as that?
You're going through that. I mean, Ofsted was just pathetic. And so a few months before the attack was launched on Trojan Horse, you know, Ofsted had given a glowing reviews to the so-called Trojan Horse schools, and it changes on a sixpence, and it was clearly, but that the judgment one must make without having looked at the case of Ofsted really carefully is that they came under political pressure and they gave in. The judiciary, well, at least the tribunal collapsed. I mean, I think in the end, it's hard to say the rule of law failed. It seems to have eventually worked. I do think one thing that greatly annoys me about it is the British media was a disaster. I mean, John Homewood wrote a book quite shortly after the Trojan Horse affair blew up, which proved beyond any question of doubt that the whole thing was a fabrication. And I find it difficult, but it's true. Not one review of that book appeared in a mainstream British newspaper. I think I'm right in saying, you might have to check with him, he's never been invited on the BBC. One of the problems is the BBC is up to its neck in this. The BBC has the corrections program, which looks at, the whole idea is to look at false media narratives and expose them. When the corrections program came to look at Trojan Horse, A, they didn't interview John Homewood, Professor Homer, and B, they reinforced some of the Islamophobic narratives. They picked up some piece of what appears to be a piece of hearsay, which was never substantiated, put into the Telegraph by Andrew Gilligan, who is one of the most, who's published a number of stories he's had to retract about Muslims. And they actually put it back into the public domain. The corrections did with no. I wrote to the BBC and asked them to explain what was going on and got a completely unsatisfactory answer. And so it's not simply the militant right, what you might call the militant Islamophobic right wing press. You have the progressive press, and you have mainstream media organizations like, above all, the BBC, all embarked on the common enterprise to misrepresent British Muslims.
And you were very critical, I remember, of Tony Blair, especially over the Iraq war. And I think you wrote a book at the time about political lying and the way by which the new political class actively lied as a means to misrepresent its agenda in the public eye. I mean, how did the Iraq war inform your thinking about how the Muslim community, or at least Islam internationally, was treated by the political and journalistic establishments?
For me personally, the Iraq war was a career turning point and a personal turning point, because I had up to that moment, I would still define myself as a Burkean conservative. And actually, much of my criticism of the current government and of the sometimes of the Labour positions comes as from a position of Burkean conservatism, a defence of religious liberty, a defence of multiculturalism, an understanding that you don't have to enforce, as the French Revolution, which Burke did, which Burke hated so much and predicted would go wrong, a kind of coercive single view on any matter, a kind of tolerance Burke allowed, which I think we are losing. But what went wrong when I came to examine the Iraq war, what you saw there was a sort of dogmatic liberalism, a refusal to understand other points of view. And among the promoters of the Gulf, of the Iraq invasion, a sort of empty, ignorant, bigoted contempt for not just for Islam, but for brown people, for foreign, you know, for what other countries and the way they choose to run themselves. And it set me on, and the British state had been complicit in this. And I find it deeply, I find it very hard to believe that the British intelligence services have been party to fabricating false information about weapons of mass destruction to justify what was an illegal war. And after that, having been pretty loyal to British government's conservative journalists, I slowly set out on a different personal direction. And that is what has led to the book I published this year. I mean, it was why I set about making it. I sort of did it quite consciously. I've got to re-examine everything I believe.
But let's turn to the Conservative Party and conservative ideology. Now, are you at risk of romanticising past conservative thinking? I mean, the party, at least in my reading, has always been quite reluctant to embrace multiculturalism. And traditional conservatism believes in monocultural societies as a form of order. There is a strong strain of empire thinking within traditional conservatism. I mean, Burke was an imperialist. Even there's a strain of cultural and possibly even ethnic superiority in early conservative thinking. And how much of this is embedded or enmeshed into the frame of thinking of conservatism, regardless of its strand, if it's neoconservatism or the more traditional one nation style conservatives?
I agree with some of what you've just said, but not all of it. Above all, what you, your, Neoconservatism is not the same as traditional conservatism. Traditional conservatism, as defined by Burke and re-articulated by Oakeshott, who was the primary, the most distinguished conservative thinker, quite difficult to read in some parts, is not as you describe it. Its key insight is that great projects, let's say the Iraq war, are dangerous because of you can't predict, or the French Revolution are dangerous because you can't predict, however virtuous your motives in going in and doing this, overthrowing the King of France or deposing Saddam Hussein. You can't predict the consequences. It's a sort of humility, almost a religious sense that only God or Allah knows. And therefore, since you haven't got the knowledge or wisdom to predict the consequences of how of great public acts, the best you can do is to observe due process, minor things like being courteous to your friends, looking after the people around you who are sick or poor, telling the truth. You could make sure that you yourself tells the truth, whereas this is a critique of the progressive left, that the progressive left sees, and hence Iraq was a left-wing project, really. Man has got such virtue and wisdom that he can embark on a great project and turn Iraq, which is oppressed by this villainous authoritarian figure, dictator Saddam, and turn it into a benign democratic society. But because that vision is so virtuous, you are justified to make it happen in lying, cheating, torturing, killing, etc., because the end justifies the means. And that's a left-wing analysis. The right-wing analysis is the opposite. That's one answer to your question, or I say right-wing, the conservative analysis. The other answer is a much more complicated answer to the conservatives' association with imperialism, which of course exists. And of course, there were terrible crimes committed under imperialism. It does not, empire is the opposite in many ways of nationalism. There's a really good essay published 2 months ago in a conservative website. I don't know if you've come across him. I don't know who I've never met him before. Chanjil Rashid. He makes this rather brilliant point, to my way of thinking, that the late Queen and her conceptions of empire and later Commonwealth were the opposite of nationalism. And actually, the Queen was the British monarchy was the great prophylactic against Enoch Powell's vein of English nationalism. And this was because, and there was a kind of very generous inclusivity about empire. This doesn't just apply to the British Empire, it would also apply to the Ottoman Empire. The ability, the wish and the desire to, and the acceptance of minorities of different religions, races, all living on an equal basis. Hence the British Nationality Act of 1948, which gave Commonwealth members the equal rights of British citizens. As British citizens, we do have an ethno-nationalist, something quite close and dangerously close to a nationalist government now in Britain under Truss, which is why she and Johnson were so, although they pretended to be fond of the Queen, Johnson lied to the Queen, remember? And Truss is now trying to exploit the monarchy, the new king, by going on his tour of the nations with him and so on, weaponizing the monarchy for political purposes. It won't survive if that is allowed to happen. Is that a coherent answer, I hope?
It's a very coherent answer, yes. And I am interested in how you represent Liz Truss. I know Boris Johnson cynically used Islam and Muslims as a means to stoke his culture wars. But you wrote recently in your Middle East Eye piece that Truss presides over a virulently Islamophobic party and contributes to that effort. I mean, how much do you believe she has bought into this narrative, or is this a phase that the party would inevitably move beyond now that they've seen the back of Boris Johnson, or have they seen the back of Boris Johnson? That's another question.
I think we can be certain that Truss is herself entirely empty, right? She has been an anti-monarchist. Now she claims to be a monarchist. She was pro-European. Now she's anti-European. She was Lib Dem. Now she's Tory. What you see here is a pure opportunist. And she's hoiked us in order to become Tory leader. She has formed this, and I don't know where you would be, this very dark deal with the European Reform Group, it's called, or is it the European Research Group, the ERG, a militant group of far-right Tory backbenchers. And she went to meet them and she convinced them that she offered the best hope for their agenda. And that's how she won the Tory leadership, and that's how she became prime minister. So she's hoiked herself into a very far-right pop. And I think people might criticise that term far-right. The Conservative Party has become something else. It is not the pragmatic British Conservative Party, which governed Britain in many ways for 200 years. It's become a narrow factional English party, hostile to the idea of Britain. It may be that she can mutate, since she is ideologically ultimately empty. She may conclude that the way she can win the next election is by abandoning these people who put her in, and returning to a more expansive version of Britishness, which traditionally the Conservative Party has represented. I, of course, hope that she will do that. Nationalism, historically, is the enemy of minorities. It tends to do so. There are terrible examples. It's the generosity of a British identity was very friendly towards immigrant groups, of whom the largest group in this country is Muslims. All immigrant groups, the Queen welcomed, hence I think she did that meeting with Paddington Bear. You know, it makes me cry when I think of it, even let alone watch it. You know, there she is welcoming this penniless migrant who comes to Britain. And you know, he says, "Thank you, Mom, for everything." I mean, it's very special, that moment. The Queen was magnificent. She was very skillful. She was a great woman. She knew how to communicate messages very softly and not intervene in politics. But what that said, the British monarchy welcomes migrants, refugees.
I would like to talk about the British monarchy, but before I do, just on the subject of Truss and the current Conservative Party, I mean, there is a paradox here. The current contemporary Conservative Party is the most diverse party probably in British politics. The four major or great offices of state are occupied by non-white men. Exactly. The last leadership campaign was conspicuous, I think, in the sheer number of non-white candidates. Doesn't this reflect a more tolerant Conservative Party in your eyes?
It's a very complicated question, because let's look at the agenda of the Conservative Party once the royal funeral is over. The first big thing is Rwanda. That, it sounds, will be intensified.
This is the Home Office policy of sending asylum seekers to process their claims in Rwanda.
Yeah, it looks like it's an illegal policy. It's right. Against the... Now, in order to make that, it looks very much under human rights law, that policy to send the refugees, perhaps is a better way, to Rwanda to be processed in camps, I don't know, is contrary to the European Court, contrary to the Human Rights Act, the European Convention of Human Rights. So we'd have to do it. We'd have to pull out of the European Convention of Human Rights, which was set up in the immediate aftermath of World War II, as we learnt the lessons. We helped to draft it. we learned the we'd learned about fascism. It's a guard against torture. It protects actually private property, a conservative idea. It protects liberty. Meanwhile, the government is under, according to, I think, a very important article in The Guardian this week, it's being accused of having two categories of citizenship, one for white Britons, you might say, one for people who've come in more recently. Very, very powerful allegations, which I haven't fully studied, but you can see there's an attack on British citizenship for all. Then we have the Shawcross report, which I talked about earlier, into Muslims and the what looks like being the intensification of a program of surveillance of Muslim citizens and so forth. Now, this is the most right-wing government Britain has probably ever had. Now, and it's the most hostile to immigrants. I mean, and this has been going on for some time, certainly since Boris Johnson became prime minister. And it is true, and it's something we, of course, should welcome, that we have the most diverse cabinet in history, as you say, with three of the four offices of state all being non-white. But I have to say that I've listened and watched the rhetoric of particularly Braverman, in which he very explicitly says that that democracy trumps rights.
So this is Suella Braverman, who is the new Home Secretary of Indian origin.
The will of the majority is more important than the rights of the minority. That is quite explicitly what she says.
There was an announcement made a couple of days ago. I read that the government is no longer going to pursue its plans to reverse or to remove the Human Rights Act. And Dominic Raab, who flirted with the idea of leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, I think that's now a thing of the past.
No. That's much too optimistic. Really? That proposal of a Bill of Rights, of amending, to sort of amend the Human Rights Act, they have dropped that.
Yes.
But if they're going to go ahead with Rwanda, I think they may attack the whole of the Human Rights Act.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I will not nearly. They can't do Rwanda
right
without moving out of the ECHR. Now, it'll be a moment, but at the you're overinterpreting.
Really? Yeah.
In my opinion, yeah. It's only an opinion.
But then, how much of the Rwanda policy was really for the public, for journalists, and less about the actual policy of removing. Migrants to be processed in Rwanda.
Well, it wasn't for journalists at all. It was it was aimed at conservative voters who don't like immigrants. Or let's be absolutely right. Don't like refugees. I mean, the people who would have voted for Nigel Farage, who's running. Oh no. That was clearly who that. You know, journalists obviously are needed as mediators in order to pass on the welcome news that. Britons are going to be stripped of their rights. But this is a frightening government. Now, I do think that let's see how Liz Truss emerges from the next couple of weeks, because it will have been a learning process for her. Maybe the Queen gave her some words of advice before she died 2 days later. She may well have dropped some pearls of wisdom in her year. But As things stand, this is a terrifying government, it's terrifying in particular to minority groups. If you're a member of the white majority, you're probably all right. I don't criticise Suella Braverman. I welcome the fact that she's a second generation immigrant, is she? Has risen to the eminence of being at the Home Office, but I think her policies are disgusting, un-British above all. They're nationalistic policies which target vulnerable people. And that is the most un-British thing you can imagine. It's disgusting. It's a betrayal of everything we stand for as a country. It's a betrayal of those who fought Nazism in World War II. It's a betrayal of the Conservative Party. She should be utterly ashamed of herself.
So Peter, do you think then that the Conservative Party now is irreparably moved beyond your type of conservatism? I mean, with Rory Stewart and Ken Clark and Dominic Gieve and Hammond and others now out of the party. They lost the whip back in 2019. And the party has almost been purged of its One Nation and traditional members. And it seems now to have a momentum in favor of what you would call a neoconservative strand. I mean, where do we now see a home for your type of conservative ideas, Peter?
We've had it with the current Conservative Party. The best hope is that it's voted out of office. It is heading off in the direction of, well, it is waging a war against the rule of law. That's what it's doing. People throw around the word fascism. I think that's previous. But what it is doing is attacking the institutions of the British state and waging and hostile to the rule of law. Now, that is really not conservative ideas at all. They have to be fought politically. The only party which can get rid of them is Keir Starmer. It's Labour. I have all sorts of reservations about Starmer, but you've got to, in these very, very dangerous circumstances, I think you'd have to support Starmer, who is not nearly outspoken enough on these issues, by the way.
Well, let's move on and talk about your thoughts on King Charles. You recently wrote a piece with my friend Imran Mullah, and you argued that he is the most Islamophile king Britain has probably ever seen, citing his very positive remarks and sympathetic remarks towards Islam. Tell me more about King Charles and his perspectives on Islam and whether you feel this will impact the current conservative policy towards Islam.
I must say, Imran Mullah was, it was his idea, that piece. And I think it illuminated me enormously trying to write it, because it showed how long-standing the Prince of Wales, now King, interest in Islam was, and how real actually Merin Khan, in response to the piece, who's the Financial Times economics correspondent, recalled he went to her university 10 years ago, and it became clear to her that he knew, in her words, far more about Sufism. It's not just a public show, far more about Sufism than she did. So it's not, it is a real, real intense engagement with all kinds of strands of Islam. Obviously, he's traveled widely and been criticized for it across the Gulf, but he's also engaged with Sufism, traditionalism, and it's part of, and he defends Islam as being part of the British tradition, and not as the current government does, with these constantly invidiously marginalizing our Muslim citizens. So he it's his knowledge and his sympathy which sets him off, differentiate him from his late mother, although I don't think she ever ever got interested. She's more interested in horses, you know, whereas I think the girls have a genuine intellectual interest in Islam. But it is remarkable, therefore, that we have a king who comes into do kings enter office? What do they do? Who ascends the throne with that kind of background?
Certainly there's been a lot of discussion in the Muslim community about King Charles, and there've been a number of videos, and your article has been doing the rounds on WhatsApp in various groups. So that's really positive. But can I suggest that I suspect, you know, King Charles does have a sincere approach towards Islam, and it's a long-standing, you know, reading of Islam and religion in general. But are we in danger of decontextualizing his otherwise positive comments? I mean, since the Arab Spring began in 2011, he's held something like 95 meetings with 8 pretty repressive Arab monarchies. and has played a key role in promoting UK arms exports. According to one figure I read, £14.5 billion of UK arms exports have been done since the Arab Spring. These regimes are notorious in their attitude towards the Muslim masses, and many of them do not accept dissent and do not take dissent very kindly. How do we square that circle? How do we place King Charles as someone who has a love for study and the study of Islam and Sufism, but King Charles as a soft power actor on behalf of the British state?
By the way, I completely agree with your analysis of what's happened since the Arab Spring. The Western, not just Britain, of course, the Western alliances with a series of dictators repressing, generally speaking, legitimate strands of political Islam, with the aided and abetted by the British state. Catherine Mayer, in her autobiography of the Prince, published in, I think, then Prince, published in 2016, revealed that he was refusing anymore to get involved in arms deals. That's been confirmed also in another authorised book by Robert Jobson about the King, published 3 years ago. And this happened apparently, reportedly, in 2015. I have, by the way, I'm relying on other sources, not me. I haven't. Which was the eve of the criminal, I mean, the Saudi attack on Yemen and the BAE Systems, which is quoted in quite a lot of the articles against Charles. And I think the British involvement in the Yemeni business is shocking and terrible, actually, and one of the worst episodes in our entire history. I'm not defending his entire record. I can see that he was used as an instrument of soft power, but I can also see that as a man of deep, rather, he does agonize about things. It's very visible. You can just see his face and you can see how much he does. He's obviously thought about it and thought that's wrong.
You know, that was Prince Charles as a prince. Now he's the monarch. His political opinions will be less strident, possibly. I mean, he effectively said that in his speech, and it is, I think most commentators now suggest that he's going to be less animated about some of these causes. I wonder whether, even if he does have a sympathy towards Islam, the constitutional monarchy means that he's really going to have to stay silent about what many would describe as and what you would describe as an extremely problematic British state policy towards the Arab and Muslim world.
Well, it's not just, if you just go through the things that Charles believes in, which the current government doesn't, but he believes in the union of the nations. In practice, the government, Truss and Johnson, praised the union, but in practice they were undermining it all the time. And then you look at the environment. I mean, the environment has been, Charles has been incredibly far-sighted, and his record of campaigning on environmental issues and being public about it. And whereas Truss, is the first thing she'd done is reintroduce fracking, and the second thing she did was to give this huge lollipop to the energy companies. And so clearly, there's going to be a major kind of. He's going to disagree with the government on all sorts of different. And Islam again, you know, he's going to. We're going to see what looks to me like a series of coercive measures against Islam or Muslims, that is to say, in the next few months at some stage. And there are other issues as well. I don't think Charles will be at all keen on the Rwanda plan. Now, he does have, and he's been warned, and actually the monarchy in this country is not a democratic institution. He's inherited his post. He hasn't been elected to it. And so there's very little, and probably nothing he can say publicly. He's entitled, according to the constitutional textbooks, think of Badgett, privately to warn. And I'm sure, as he did Prince Charles against the Iraq War, report as one reads in the books. But he not much more than that. He can set a tone. It'll be Charles will have to learn how to stand up for these issues against what I think is a nationalist English government.
I want to turn to one final question, and you've been very generous with your time, Peter, and thank you for staying the course with me. As a British Muslim, I've noticed that many young Muslims are now looking to move away from Britain. It's probably not as stark as it is in Europe. In France, there is an exodus of North Africans, Muslims who feel persecuted by the state. But there is a sizable minority, let's say, of young Muslims who wish to live a life elsewhere, whether it's in another European state or most more likely in a Muslim state. I mean, I was in Turkey for a number of months last year, and I found that there was a substantial trickle of families who are now moving to Istanbul from London, and these are second, third generation Muslims. They're not migrants, but they've decided to start a new life in Istanbul. I mean, there's a question in there somewhere, but what's your feeling about that? I mean, you know, do you find that a justifiable move or response to what you've been writing about for the last two decades? You know, a very anti Muslim environment.
Yeah, I can certainly see why Muslims are moving out of France. Moving out of Britain, it really upsets me, by the way. I'm very interested, and I might write about it. Perhaps we should talk about this subject. Yeah.
Please.
You can see the rash reason for it, that Britain was, and this is one of the things the Queen personally represented, a multicultural society. We celebrated multiculturalism. That was the British settlement. And what we have seen, and Brexit has been part of it, is a move towards a rejection of multiculturalism. Actually, it was happening before Brexit, the David Cameron speech.
Yeah, muscular liberalism.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was captured, really, by the American think tanks, I think. And if you remember, he started off as Tory leader, but going to live with a Muslim family and saying how much we had to learn from Islam. But then he seemed to change his mind. So it really breaks my heart what you just told me. I didn't know that. But you can see, I do think that the atmosphere towards Muslims, think of the prevent strategy, has changed.
And I would say, by the way, prevent is the one policy that has resonated in the Muslim community. And those people I spoke to in Istanbul, they all cited prevent as one major reason why they just didn't feel comfortable in Britain. And
I tell you what, I must write a piece about this.
Yeah, I think it's,
so. When we stay in touch on this,
please,
and let's write a major piece. But I hope, look, there's a struggle ahead. This particular government has got at most, well, he has to have called an election by January 2025 at the latest. A lot is going to happen before then. And I hope that Britain does not turn into a sort of homogenous ethnic state too fast. And we must resist this. And it is a major campaign. I hope that Labour can be convinced to come out against the prevent strategy. I haven't seen it doing so far. Have you?
No, I haven't. I mean, if anything, Angela Rayner made that really horrible statement about shooting first and then asking questions later when it comes to terrorism or terrorist suspects, which really didn't play very well in the Muslim community. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a cynic in me, but the feeling after Corbyn, regardless of his politics and where he stands. I mean, the feeling after Corbyn is that the Labour Party shares much of the maybe not the virulent Islamophobia, but much of the tendencies of, especially when it comes to securitization, those policies of the Conservatives are shared probably by the current Labour Party.
The defeat of Corbynism has got all kinds of consequences, and it may just be a Starmer judges that as he seeks to get rid of this Conservative government, he got to make certain compromises or concessions to right-wing opinion.
Yeah, I mean, that's a worry, I think, for lots of Muslims. And maybe as a final point, I mean, I think certainly writing about what I think is a substantial move. I mean, I think it's really mainly amongst younger Muslims who are now looking to move beyond the UK. And maybe that's just part of life and they want to work elsewhere. But my anecdotal discussions with them, they would cite policies like Prevent and sort of an agenda where they feel the lives of themselves and their kids, and they no longer feel comfortable. In communities like Luton or Waltham Forest, where there are large numbers of Muslims, there is a feeling that the hand of the state is on our shoulders.
It's very upsetting, and it's very profound what you're just saying. And let's hope we can change the atmosphere back.
Well, Peter Urban, thank you for your time today. It's really been a fascinating discussion and quite a wide-ranging discussion. I really appreciate your time with us today.
Thank you very much indeed. I really enjoyed talking to you, and let's talk again. And remember to keep let's talk again about and write something about the way that Muslims are being driven out of Britain by Prevent and other anti-Muslim measures.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.